Chapter 12. While at Ensenado, our communications for business with Buenos Aires required us to cross the pampas, or vast prairies lying on the south of that province. To do this, and also to protect ourselves from highway robbers, we united in bands and armed ourselves for defense. Our way was first about 20 miles across the prairie, and then 20 miles further over the Lumas, or highlands, to the city. Once out on this vast prairie without a guide is next to being on the vast ocean without a compass. Not a tree nor a shrub nor anything but reeds and tall wild grass to be seen as far as the eye can extend. About the only things to attract attention and relieve the mind while passing through the deep and dangerous muddy reed bogs and still miry marshes, fording creeks and running streams, were occasional flocks of sheep, herds of swine, horned cattle, and horses, all quietly feeding in their own organized order. On the two last mentioned might be seen large and small birds quietly perching on their backs, having no other resting place. Mounted on our hired half-wild horses, stationing our well-paid postilion ahead, we thus passed over this 20-mile prairie, rank and file, following in the cattle's miry mud tracks, part of the time our arms around the horses' necks, fearing lest we should be thrown into a mud hole among the reeds or left to swim in the stream. After some 4 hours journeying, the Lumas would appear ahead, then a farmhouse, and then the halfway home or tavern for dinner and change of horses. Soon a herd of 100 or more horses were driven out from the prairie into a corral or yard and set going with full speed around the yard, while the men with their lassos or long hide ropes with a noose at the end, in a most dexterous manner, would throw their noose over their heads and bring them up to the post. Then, wild or not, they were held until the rider mounted, when they would start rank and file again after the postilion, and soon follow the leading horse without turning, as they had learned to go with the herds on the prairie. The same order is observed on returning back to Ensenado. During our stay here, the numerous arrivals from the United States overstocked the market and opened the way for me to purchase a cargo for the Pacific on reasonable terms. The Chatsworth was now loaded and cleared for Lima in Peru. As I had resolved on my previous voyage never more to use ardent spirits only for medicinal purposes, so now, on leaving Buenos Aires, I also resolved that I would never drink another glass of wine. In this work of reform, I found myself entirely alone and exposed to the jeering remarks of those with whom I afterward became associated, especially when I declined drinking with them. Yet after all their comments that it was not improper or dangerous to drink moderately, they were constrained to admit that my course was perfectly safe. Passing from the northern into the southern hemisphere, one is struck with the remarkable change in the starry heavens. Before reaching the equator, the well-known North Star is apparently setting on the northern horizon, and a great portion of the well-known stars in the northern hemisphere are receding from the mariner's view. But this loss is supplied by the splendid, new and varied scenery in the southern heavens, as he sails onward toward the southern polar regions. Here, away in the southwestern heavens, in the track of the Milky Way, every starlight night can be seen two small stationary white clouds called by sailors the Magellanic Clouds. Ferguson says, by the aid of the telescope, they appear to be a mixture of small clouds and stars. But most remarkable of all the cloudy stars, he says, is that in the middle of Orion's sword, where 7 stars, 3 of which are very close together, seem to shine through a cloud. It looks like a gap in the sky, through which one may see as it were a part of a much brighter region. Although most of these spaces are but a few minutes of a degree in breadth, yet since they are among the fixed stars, they must be spaces larger than what is occupied by our solar system. and in which there seems to be a perpetual, uninterrupted day among numberless worlds which no human art can ever discover. This gap or place in the sky is undoubtedly the same that is spoken of in the Scriptures. See John 1, verse 51, Revelation 19, verse 11. The center of this constellation, Orion, is midway between the poles of heaven and directly over the equator of the earth, and comes to the meridian about the 23rd of January at 9 o'clock in the evening. Inspiration testifies that the worlds were framed by the Word of God, Hebrews 11, verse 3. He hangeth the earth upon nothing. By His Spirit He hath garnished the heavens, Job 36, verse 7 and 13. On our passage from Buenos Aires to Cape Horn, we arrived in the vicinity of the Falkland Islands, between 300 and 400 miles northeast of the Cape. Here we endeavored to make a harbor during a storm by beating up into Falkland Sound, but the increasing gale obliged us to bear up and continue our southern course. On arriving off Cape Horn about July and August, the coldest and most stormy season of the year, for about 30 days we were contending with prevailing westerly gales and floating islands of ice from the polar regions, trying, as sailors say, to double Cape Horn. While lying to under a balanced reefed trysail off the Cape, in a heavy westerly gale, a heavy cross sea boarded us on our larboard side, which stove in our bulwarks and stanchions, and ripped up the plankshire, and washed them up against the mast from near the windlass to the cabin gangway. In this exposed and perilous condition, liable to be filled with water and sunk immediately, we set the close-reefed main topsail, and put the vessel before the wind, and to keep her still more steady, we packed on also a reefed foresail, which increased her speed so furiously that it prevented her from rolling the open space under water only occasionally. Fortunately, we had a new main hatch tarpaulin at hand. With strips of this, all hands were now engaged, as opportunity offered, to get it over the open spaces and drive a nail to secure it and rush back to our holding on places until the ship rolled again to leeward. In about 2 hours, we secured in this way, temporarily, the open space, took in our main topsail and foresail, and hove to again on the same tack under a balanced reefed trysail. Then, after pumping out the water and clearing away the wreck, we had time to reflect on our narrow escape from utter destruction and how God, in kindness, had opened the way for us to save ourselves in this trying hour. After the gale had abated, next day we repaired damages more thoroughly, and at the expiration of some 30 days struggling off Cape Horn against westerly gales and driving snowstorms, we were enabled to double the Cape and shape our course for the island of Juan Fernandez, some 1,400 miles north of us. The westerly winds were now in our favor, so that in a few days we changed our climate and were passing along in sight of this far-famed island, once the whole world to Robinson Crusoe. After sailing north some 2,600 miles from the stormy Cape, the towering mountains of Peru could be distinctly seen, though some 80 miles distant from the coast. Passing onward, we cast our anchor in the spacious bay of Callao, about 6 miles west of the celebrated city of Lima. North American produce was in good demand. Some of my first sales of flour were over $70 per barrel. A few cargoes arriving soon after us reduced the price to $30. Here I chartered the Chatsworth to a Spanish merchant for a voyage to Pisco, some 100 miles further south, with the privilege of disposing of my cargo and returning with his. Soon after our arrival here, the chief mate and two of the men went up to the village, about 3 miles from the harbor, to procure beef and vegetables for dinner. The men soon returned with the statement that the patriot soldiers had descended from the mountains and besieged the village, and pillaged the stores where some of our cargo was exposed for sale, and had driven the mate out on one side of the village to shoot him, and also declared that they were coming down to take our vessel and dispose of me because of the Spanish merchant we had brought them from Lima. The mate soon appeared on the beach. After the boat brought him on board, he said that the soldiers, on learning that he was the mate of the Chatsworth, drove him on one side of the village to shoot him. On arriving at the place, one of the soldiers persuaded the others not to kill him. They then concluded to let him go, but beat him most unmercifully with their swords. We made preparations to defend ourselves, but our enemies thought best not to expose themselves within reach of our cannonballs. Notwithstanding our opposing foes who continued to threaten us, we disposed of all our cargo here at better prices than was offered at Cayo, and returned to Cayo with the Spanish merchant's cargo. While at Cayo, a whale made his appearance in the bay. A Nantucket whale ship there at the time followed him with their boats and harpooned him. The whale rushed in among the shipping, with the boat in tow, like a streak through the foaming water, and dashed down directly under the bottom of a large English brig, giving her pursuers but a moment's warning to chop off their line and save their lives, something like leaving her compliments with her unknown foes, saying, "If you follow me here, you will never harpoon another poor whale." The whale rushed through the fleet of shipping to the head of the bay in shoal water. The boat followed and fastened to her again when she came streaming out of the bay, and in a little while we could but just discern the boat as the sun was setting in the offing with her waft flying, signifying that the whale was dead. Lieutenant Connor, now Commodore, who commanded the United States schooner Dolphin, got under way and the next day arrived with the whale and boat in tow. By invitation, the following day, the citizens of Lima came down in numbers to witness how the North Americans cut in and stow away the big whales found in the waters. The climate in this region is healthy, and the scenery most delightful. There are floating white clouds, beyond which may be seen the indigo-colored sky, apparently twice the distance from the earth that it is in North America. And then there is the sweet, salubrious air, and strong trade winds, and evergreen fields, and trees bending with delicious fruit, while the ground continually teems with vegetation for both man and beast. There are no storms of rain, and the people say it never rains there. Their city is walled and guarded on the east by towering mountains, easy of ascent, even above the white-capped clouds which sail below the admiring beholder, until they strike a higher ledge of the mountains, then rise and float away over the vast Pacific on the west. And still further in the distance, on the east, about 90 leagues, lie in huge piles the continually snow-capped Andes, all plain to the naked eye, which continually send forth gushing streams that water the plains below. This is also conveyed by means of walled ditches to the streets of the city. Much more could be added to this interesting description to make a residence there very desirable, but one shock of an earthquake, and they are frequent there, perhaps in the dead of the night, when the inhabitants rush into the streets to save themselves from falling dwellings, crying, wailing, and screaming aloud for mercy, is enough to make one perfectly willing and in a hurry to exchange his position for almost any region where the earth rests quietly on its own foundation. It is stated in Mr. Haskell's Chronology of the World that Lima was destroyed by an earthquake in October 1746. This, I think, could not have been the city of Lima, but the seaport of the city called Cayo. For the most celebrated and central part of the city of Lima is the Palace Square, on one side of which then stood a very ancient, long one-story wooden building, where the city officers transacted their business. I was frequently told that this building was the palace or dwelling place of the Spanish adventurer Pizarro, after his conquest of Peru. If this statement was correct, then it will be allowed that Pizarro occupied it long before the earthquake in 1746. Hence that part of the city could not have been destroyed, but her seaport called Cayo was. The city of Lima is situated about 6 miles in the interior from her seaport, Cayo, and is about 700 feet above the level of the sea on an inclined plane. While I was there in 1822-1823, 77 years after the earthquake, I frequently visited the place to view the massive piles of brick from about 18 inches underwater to as far down as I could see that composed the buildings and walls of the place at the time of the earthquake. I was told that a Spanish frigate was lying moored in the harbor at the time, and after its destruction by the earthquake, she was found 3 miles inland, about halfway from the port of Cayo, to the city of Lima, some 350 feet above the level of the sea. Allowing this statement to be true, and I never heard anyone attempt to disprove it, then it must have been the earthquake that caused the earth first to rise under the sea, causing the body of water between it and the land to rush on with such force that the frigate was carried up the inclined plane, and when the water receded, she was left some 3 miles from the seashore. From all appearances, Cayo was overflowed by the sea, for its ruins lie nearly on a level with the sea and are under a lake of water separated from the ocean by a sandbar. I have heard and also observed that the sea does not rise and fall here at stated periods as it does in almost all other harbors and places. Hence it is clear that the body of water which covers the ruins of Cayo is not furnished from the sea. Another singular curiosity in this place was the cemetery, about 5 miles out of the city, which was different from anything I had ever seen. At the entrance was the church with the cross. Part of the way round the cemetery was double-walled. The space or passway between these walls appeared to be about 40 feet wide. The walls were about 8 feet high and 7 thick, with 3 rows of cells where they deposited the dead. These were rented to those who could afford to deposit their dead in this style for 6 months or any length of time. Some of these cells were bricked up, and others had iron doors that were locked. The unoccupied ones were open for rest. In the center, between the walls, were deep vaults covered with iron gratings, in which we could see dead bodies all tumbled together without order. I learned that when the 6 months or whatever time the cells were rented for closed, the bodies were taken out and pitched into the vaults in the center. Thus they could accommodate others. In another department, the dead were buried underground in rows. Nearby the church was a large circular vault with a steepletop covering resting on pillars several feet above the vault. This was another burying place. On looking over the railing placed around it to prevent the living from falling in, the sight was most revolting. Some stood erect, others with their heads downward, and in every imaginable position, just as they happened to fall from the handbarrow, with their ragged, unclean clothing on in which they died. These, of course, were the abject poor, whose friends were unable to pay rent for a burying place underground or in one of the whitewashed cells in the walls. The dead soldiers were carried out of the forts and dumped in here with little ceremony. The air is so salubrious there that no offensive smell arises from these dead bodies. They literally waste away and dry up.